The chapter of Ready Player One covered in this episode features a neologism that, by accident, sounds exactly like a racist pejorative. As ever, I criticise its handling and inclusion and advise you to listen with care if necessary. Hello and welcome back to Ready Player None, the only podcast that's back in POG form. Today we're looking at Chapter 22. Wade's moping and general complacency have meant that he's missed out on the next step of the hunt. We join him as he voyages to where Artemis uncovered the Jade Egg. And if you think that sounds like a familiar description, it's because in the previous chapter nothing happened. Why don't you and I see if anything happens this week? Wade's ship, the Vonnegut, exits lightspeed at the planet I've decided to belligerently pronounce as Archide. We find out that in this entire simulation of beautifully rendered planets, Archide resembled the vector graphic Death Star from Atari's 1983 Star Wars arcade game. So it's a planet that's almost completely black with green pixely outlines, and it's the home to the Oasis's largest classic video game museum. It's also a PvP zone, like most museums. Sorry, that was a dumb one. So I made sure to load up all of my combat contingency macros.
There's that word again.
The Vonnegut lands on the surface, and there's a couple of things I just want to pick up here. First, he describes the loading ramp as perfectly rendered. I just think that's really stupid. The Vonnegut's perfectly rendered steel loading ramp lowered to the ground. So we know that it's steel and it's a ramp. Why be any more descriptive than saying it's a steel ramp when you can say that it's perfectly rendered? Just imagine what a computer graphics ramp looks like and you bang on the money. Wade also uses a keypad on his right wrist to activate the ship's security system. A transparent blue shield appeared around the Vonnegut's hull. Did you mean translucent? So down on the surface of Archide, it's also completely black, but there's a distant, jagged, green vector line denoting mountainous terrain, which is described as looking like the environment of the 1981 game Battlezone. I'm tempted to sort of let him off for saying that the video game museum planet looks like video games, but I won't. The environment on the horizon always looks the same, no matter what distance away you are from it, even if you circumnavigated the globe. I gotta say, if this entire planet is made out of green vector graphics lines, how did nobody suspect it was part of the hunt sooner? Green lines? Jade Key? Halliday was a huge nerd for this kind of stuff? I feel like this was a dot that could have been connected much earlier. So Wade's personal assistant, Max Headroom, has set the Vonnegut down in a landing lot near the equator in the eastern hemisphere. The lot was empty and the surrounding area appeared deserted. I headed towards the nearest green dot. As I approached, I could see that it was actually the mouth of an entrance tunnel, a neon green circle 10 meters in diameter leading below ground. So if the planet's completely black with nothing but green grid lines on it, and a distant skybox you can never reach, navigating is going to be awful. For a museum, that's a really user-unfriendly experience. Wade goes down the hole and hears the song Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard, which is definitely not from a vector graphics arcade game. So that constitutes this episode's first instance of two things that don't belong together being mashed up. Archide is a hollow planet, filled with perfect recreations of old arcades. But this isn't the work of one coder, this is the work of many people who, like Ernest Cline, can't let go of the past. Since the dawn of the Oasis, thousands of elderly users had come here and painstakingly coded virtual replicas of local arcades they remembered from their childhood, thus making them a permanent part of the museum. It's a subterranean labyrinth of interconnected arcades, pizza joints, bowling alleys for some reason. I think it's interesting that in Ernest Cline's picture of the world, these elderly people are recreating their memories in virtual reality. It's like the modern day trend towards people buying old vinyl records, because they sounded more authentic to what they sounded like back then. It's a bit like that, only the exact opposite, because you can't get authenticity in virtual reality recreations. The planet's mantle is where they keep the last coin-operated video games ever made from the first few decades of the 21st century. For all his veneration about arcade games, Ernest Cline doesn't seem to be aware that arcades still exist. It's 2020 and they're still making new arcade cabinets. Of course, this wouldn't be the first thing that this book has really poor foresight about. As Wade descends deeper into the planet, the games become older and more archaic. Archaic arcades. Like the old 93 cents per gallon petrol from, 10 chapters ago. This next bit exists to purely say, hey, remember coin-op video games? Remember fighting games with blocky polygon men? Remember light guns? Remember dance games? Remember vector graphics? Remember cathode picture tubes? Wade tells us that at the bottom level of the museum, there's a spherical shrine that serves as the planet's core, containing working versions of the first two video games ever made, Tennis for Two and Space War! That's got an exclamation mark at the end, so I had to shout it. So the implication there is that these are the shoulders of giants that every other video game stood upon. Like most Gunters, I'd already visited Archide a few times. When? You couldn't even afford space travel at the start of this book. I'd been to the core and had played both Tennis for Two and Space War until I'd mastered them. Until you'd mastered them. Oh look, another thing that Wade has had infinite amount of time to get good at. Wade keeps running until he reaches his destination, the GSS Museum. He's been there before, so he knows exactly where to find Halliday's 5 trophies. And that would be next to a bronze statue of the man himself. Yep, that's right. Ernest Cline's first self-insert has been deified to the point of having a bronze statue of himself in his own museum, on his own planet, in his own simulated universe. Ernest doesn't want a world revolving around pop culture, he just wants a world revolving around him. Through generous application of a laser cutter, Wade discovers that the trophies are coded to remain in the cabinet. There's no way of removing them, so he considers this entire trip to be a complete waste of time. So he's frustrated and he's dejected, so he leaves the museum and wanders through paths that he's never really explored before. And his route takes him into a giant cavernous chamber. It contained a kind of underground city comprised entirely of pizza joints, bowling alleys, convenience stores, and, of course, video arcades. So wandering through, he finds this dead-end alley containing Happy Time Pizza. It was a replica of a small, family-run pizza joint that had existed in Halliday's hometown in the mid-1980s. So Wade's immediately curious about this place. Nobody's ever mentioned that it exists here, even though it seems like such a huge clue. So he goes inside and it's a combination pizzeria and game room, it says. There are NPCs cooking pizzas. He can turn on his olfatrix. Olfatrix? Neither of those sounds quite right. Which is a smell-o-vision thing I didn't bother to talk about a few chapters ago. He can turn on his olfatrix to smell the tomato sauce. And it turns out if you sit at the counter and order a slice of pizza, it notifies the nearest pizza vendor in the real world and it delivers a slice directly to his door within minutes. Now that is the kind of future I'm looking forward to. So half of this place is a games room, but you could still play games in the pizza half. All of the glass top tables were actually sit-down arcade games known as cocktail cabinets. You could sit and play Donkey Kong on the table while you ate your pizza. Personally, I've always found these cocktail cabinets really cool, so sorry to let you down on that one. There's a Bryan Adams song playing. He doesn't tell us which one it is, but he does quote slightly from the lyrics, and I'm not going to look it up. I'm sure there's some deep subtextual reason for why this song is playing, Ernest. But I'm not going to be a cooperative reader and make the rest of the leap for you. So there's a cabinet here of Defender, and there's a handwritten note taped to it saying, "Beat the owner's high score and win a free large pizza." And then there's a few paragraphs about how there's a Robotron game here and what that's all about. There's a Galaga and a Dig Dug, and finally, 220 pages in, there's Pac-Man. Can you believe it? 220 pages in, we finally got our first reference to Pac-Man. It was conspicuous by its absence, let me tell you. And this Pac-Man cabinet looks well worn. In fact, it's out of order, with a sign taped on the screen. Wade's a bit curious, so he pulls the machine out from the wall and plugs it back in. It seems to boot up fine, and in pushing it back to the wall, he notices a single quarter resting on the metal brace that held the glass marquee in place. The quarter was minted in 1981. So of course he knows that A, that was the year Pac-Man was released, and B, placing a quarter in that position means that you're reserving the next game. But this quarter feels like it's welded in place, it can't be removed. He takes the sign off and sees that the high score of the game is 3,333,350 points. Several things were strange about this. In the real world, Pac-Man machines didn't save their high score if they were unplugged, and the high score counter was supposed to flip over at 1,000,000 points. But this machine displayed a high score of 3,333,350 points, just 10 points shy of the highest Pac-Man score possible. That's another three instances of improbable information that Wade knows. But, spurred on by the promises of a free pizza, Wade decides to try and play a perfect game to beat the score. Less than 20 perfect games had been documented in the game's 60-year history. One of them, the fastest perfect game ever played, had been accomplished by James Halliday in just under 4 hours. Because every character that represents Ernest Cline has to be perfect at everything. Because I knew Halliday loved the game, I'd already done a fair amount of research on Pac-Man. Of course you had. Who's ready for another list? This one's about all the Pac-Man related data that Wade has in his Grail diary. The original game code. The unabridged biography of the designer, Toru Iwatani. Every Pac-Man strategy guide ever written. Every episode of the Pac-Man cartoon series. The ingredients for Pac-Man cereal. And of course, patterns. What? I had Pac-Man pattern diagrams out the wazoo. What's a pattern diagram? Along with hundreds of hours of archived video of the best Pac-Man players in history. So of course Wade knows everything there already is to know about Pac-Man, because Wade knows everything about conceivably everything. So with his memory of Pac-Man refreshed, he's going to face this game head on. I stretched my arms, rolled my head and neck around on my shoulders, and cracked my knuckles. All of which is completely pointless on two different levels. Because he's a child who's trying to act like a big fighter or action hero when actually just playing a video arcade game inside a video game simulation. There's no point for your avatar to do those actions. And if I assume that Wade himself is doing them, well, that just doesn't make sense with this stupid haptic chair, does it? When I dropped a quarter into the left coin slot, the game emitted a familiar electronic boop sound. That's actually the sound that I've been using to censor the swears. I promise I didn't just swear in the middle of that sentence. I wrapped my right hand around the joystick and began to play, guiding my pizza-shaped protagonist through one maze after another. Wacka, 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 wacka. That's just presented as a sentence on its own, as if it's the most profound thing you've ever heard. And consequently, Wade begins to concentrate entirely on this Pac-Man game. And then we've got a page break. So in the space of the page break, Wade has now spent 6 hours playing Pac-Man. He hasn't won on his first attempt. This is his 8th try. So he's not an infallible Pac-Man player, but his failings are relegated to 2 sentences, and we're only given a summary of what will transpire to be his successful run. I was rocking like Dokken. This game had been Iceman perfect so far. Every reference that Ernest Cline makes that I don't recognise, I count as a victory towards me, because it means I'm not turning into a minutia-obsessed weirdo like he is. Now, he's just short of explaining what the final screen of Pac-Man actually is. It's never actually made clear what's going on. So if you've not heard of it, the arcade version of Pac-Man has what's called the kill screen, and it's something to do with memory overflow and there only being 256 available values of something. I don't know. I'm not a programmer. So once you reach screen 256, something overflows and loops you back around to zero. The left-hand side of the screen is a standard Pac-Man labyrinth, but the right-hand side is a jumble of mixed-up sprites, mostly letters and numbers. So unless you memorise it through trial and error, the right-hand side of the screen is completely unnavigable. But apparently that right-hand side of the screen still contains dots to collect, and collecting them is the only way you can get a perfect score. I was having the best game of my life. This was it. I could feel it. Everything was finally falling into place. I had the glow. And apparently there's a spot in each maze, just above the starting position, where it was possible to hide Pac-Man for up to 15 minutes. Is that true? That's nothing I've ever heard of. But if you were wondering when he managed to eat and go to the toilet, well, that's how he did it. Once he gets halfway through the 255th screen, Pac-Man fever starts playing from the game room stereo. A smile crept onto my face. I knew this had to be a small tip of the hat from Halliday. So yeah, description here about how he played Pac-Man. He calls the tunnel at the side of the screen the secret door. What? I never heard it called the secret door. In the comments below, tell me if you've ever heard somebody call the tunnel in Pac-Man the secret door. So Wade succeeds at level 255 and ends up on the kill screen. What's the matter, Pac-Man? You look like you've seen a ghost. Sorry. Then, in the worst case of bad timing imaginable, a scoreboard alert flashed on my display just a few seconds after I began to play through the final screen. Wouldn't it be funny if Wade's doing all this for 6 hours of his life and it's just not relevant to anything at all? Oh, maybe it isn't relevant to anything at all, because the scoreboard alert is H getting the Jade Key as well. Wade's now in third place behind the two people he's alienated. Wade's trying to concentrate on the maze. Doing the left half is easy enough, but it's finding those hidden dots in the right-hand side that's tough. I couldn't see them, but I had their locations memorised. Is there anything you haven't memorised? I quickly found and ate all 9, gaining 90 more points. Now, after this subsequent sentence, after this subsequent paragraph, in fact, the book tells us that the way to succeed at this game, the way to win a perfect game of Pac-Man, is to collect these 9 dots, die to one of the ghosts, collect them again, and keep collecting them for the remainder of your 5 lives. That's fine. So what Ernest intends to put here is that Wade's character of Pac-Man commits suicide by going directly into the nearest ghost. Pac-Man suicide. Now, Ernest, unfortunately, decides to make a portmanteau out of these 2 words. Are you ready for this? He calls it committing Pac-icide. Are you absolutely kidding me? Did nobody at any point reading in this book, no sensitivity readers or anything, stop and think for a minute that sounds like a word for genociding Pakistani people. Are you absolutely joking? This is so stupid. Right, what else have we got? So, Wade thinks about how H is probably holding the jade key and reading the inscription, playing Pac-Man so well he could do it blindfolded, and then, surprising nobody, he succeeds at the perfect score. I took my hands off the controls and watched as all four ghosts converged on Pac-Man. Game over flashed in the center of the maze. I waited. Nothing happened. After a few seconds, the game's attract screen came back up, showing the four ghosts, their names, and their nicknames. I'm telling you, it would be really funny if just nothing happened as a result of this and he's wasted 6 hours of his time. But then the 1981 quarter on the cabinet drops off the edge and lands directly in his hand, and then vanishes into his inventory. When I tried to take it back out and examine it, I found that I couldn't. The quarter icon remained in my inventory. I couldn't take it out or drop it. Yeah, so he's got this new item that he can't use in any way, and it doesn't even have an item description. You know, like he's a creepypasta protagonist. But he's got no time to worry about this mystery quarter. Instead, he's going to sulk about how both Artemis and H have got to the Jade Key before he has. And getting the high score on this Pac-Man game on Archide obviously hadn't got me any closer to finding it myself. I really had been wasting my time here. Teehee. Back on his ship, he receives an email from H. I felt my pulse quicken when I saw its subject line. Payback time. And the message reads, Dear Parzival, you and I are officially even now. Got that? I consider my debt to you hereby paid in full. Better hurry. The Sixers must already be on their way there. Good luck, H. Much like Wade gave him the clue about the D&D module ages ago, H is now returning the favour by sending him a high-resolution scan of the instruction manual cover for the text adventure game Zork. Of course, Wade has already played and solved Zork back during the first year of the hunt, but apparently he played so many text adventures that year that they've all sort of faded into memory. Yeah, right. That'd be a first, wouldn't it? Most old text adventure games were pretty self-explanatory, so I'd never actually bothered to read the Zork instruction manual. I now knew that this had been a colossal mistake. Now, because this book isn't a visual medium, it takes time to describe the cover of Zork. And because I'm a podcast on the internet, I encourage you to go and look it up yourself. But in the background of this battle scene between a heroic barbarian-looking guy and a weird little toothy creature, there was a large white house with its front door and windows all boarded up. And this is their dwelling long neglected from the quatrain. There you go. So Wade sets course for another planet in Sector 7.
Never heard of it. Never will.
So at least he was in the right sector. It was a small world called Froboz that was home to a detailed recreation of the game Zork. Take a drink every time there's a detailed recreation of something. It was also, I now knew, the hiding place of the Jade Key. End chapter 22. So how's that then? Much like the previous chapter, Wade made no progress in his quest, but at least this time it was funny because he was doing completely the wrong thing on completely the wrong planet. Now I'm assuming that quarter is going to be something that Ernest Klein expects you to forget about. It's obviously going to come into play at some point. Wade is such a special chosen one protagonist that he somehow managed to stumble directly into the correct pizzeria in the correct town on an entire planet of pizza places and arcades. And it's weird how there's no mention of any other people on this entire planet. Like, this sector's supposed to be crawling with Sixers and Gunters, and yet Wade's got the run of the place. I suppose Ernest just didn't want to interrupt 6 hours of thrilling Pac-Man nostalgia. The visual of this vector graphic planet is a neat idea, but I think realistically it would be awful to navigate. Once more, Wade's ridiculous amount of knowledge about things from the past has proven a boon to him in a challenge that he has no right in actually succeeding. And that unfortunate neologism about Pac-Man's suicide was just symptomatic of the true elephant in the room that is this book's complete dearth of references to media by persons of colour. Well, unless you're a Japanese kids show, Ernest Klein truly is the whitest man that you know. For more from white men who should know better, follow me on Twitter at TheLastGherkin or follow the show on Twitter at RPN_pod. Watch with subtitles on YouTube, The Last Gherkin, or get an MP3 download at TheLastGherkin.podbean.com. Join us next time when, with any luck, Wade is likely to be eaten by a Gru. I've just managed to get this episode in the can before the council's brought around an enormous lawn mowing machine. Can you hear that? and the horizon is always the same distance away from you. You can never reach it. That was a redundant sentence. That's what a horizon is.
Falco, I'm going to destroy the world.
But spurred on by the promise of a free pizza, Wade decides...
Was that the Bite of 87?